Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
Award-winning author Rob Davidson teaches creative writing and American literature at California State University, Chico. He has published 4 collections of short fiction, including Spectators, Flash Fictions. His newest book is What Some Would Call Lies, consists of 2 novellas. Rob Davidson, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
Now, even on the cover of your book, there's a question, and you probably have already gotten this question often. Rob, what is a novella?
Yes. It's a literary form that I love and read a lot of. I unfortunately find fewer people read those today. They're less common, I guess, at least in literary circles. So I would define a novella as something in between a short story and a novel. Catherine Ann Porter called them short novels, whatever that means. But to me, they have a particular sort of autonomy of themselves. I guess I would say a short story is not a scalable medium. So whatever you know about writing the short story, you can't directly apply it to the writing of a novella. It has its own logic, has its own kind of organic feel. And to me, the stories that I wrote here obviously demanded more space and multiple storylines, but not as big and as sprawling as a novel, which can be, a lot of fun to read and write, more room for tangents or wandering around or lingering. But in a novella, it's a little more like a short story in the sense that you need to keep things moving. It needs to be an economy of space and ideas. So that is some of what a novella means to me.
Have you ever thought of submitting anything to The New Yorker?
Thought of, and I have done it. They do occasionally take work over the transom, as we call it. So it's not an impossibility, but most of the stuff that gets into The New Yorker or Harper's is agented material. And I guess another way to think about the form of the novella is in terms of the marketplace. I did approach agents and editors, multiple agents and editors with this book, and basically got a lot of head scratching. They don't know how to market novellas. They know how to market novels. They even, know how to market books of short stories, but several times I was told, I don't know who I would sell this to. Or
it falls between what they're familiar with.
In terms of the market. And since it's a less frequently written and less frequently read form, you don't go to the bookstore and say, can you point out the greatest, recent collections of novellas? Yeah. But you might ask the clerk about the greatest novel of the last 6 months or something like that. But anyway... I don't worry too much about the marketplace when I'm sitting down to be creative. I just write the story that I feel like I need to write. And these felt very much like they needed to be longer. And I enjoyed writing it. A challenge for me as a writer is a new form. My first 2 books were what I'll call sort of standard length short stories, sort of 3,000 to 6,000 word stories. Then I wrote a book of flash fictions, which was a very different kind of challenge formally. And then now I'm on to novellas.
Well, you might, since you mentioned flash fiction, your last book, how that differs from the novella.
For me...
Because they're both fiction.
Oh, yeah, they're both fiction. For me, they felt really different. Writing the flash fictions, and my flash fictions are very short. They're a page long. They're more like prose poems.
In fact, I was going to say some people would probably call them a poem.
Yeah. And they're more lyric and... concerned with the rhythm and the music of the language. And, to be frank, you can kind of get in and get out a lot faster and write a bunch of them. And then suddenly you've got 50 or 60 of these things and you're thinking, okay, that's a book. Not that you don't work hard on them, you do, but they feel you're driven to work with a kind of radical concision in terms of the language and what you're writing about. Whereas with a novella, it is a longer, more drawn out, expansive form. And also it took me, I think I wrote Spectators in about a year. This book.
Spectators was your collection of flash fiction, as
yes,
you say.
Yes, thank you. And the novella is what some would call Lies. I worked on them off and on for 12 years, which is a, geologic amount of time.
My guest is Rob Davidson, and his newest collection, I almost hesitate to use the word collection, is some would call lies, what some would call lies, because it's a collection of two novelas.
Yeah, I think if mathematically that's the smallest number you could use.
Call it a collection.
To call it a collection. Yeah, I mean, I think of it as a collection because the two novellas have shared themes, and they're independent. You don't need to have read one to understand the other, but hopefully some readers will pick up on some of the shared themes like memory and authorship, and they're both in their own ways coming-of-age stories.
Another difference I noticed in your flash fiction, where you have to be very concise, economical with your words, so there's no room for dialogue, really, but in your novellas, your two novellas, there's wonderful dialogue. I loved reading the dialogue in your two novellas.
Sure. They're both more scene-driven, more dramatic.
Yeah. In fact, I could see it in my head as on a stage, being performed on a stage.
Oh, good. That's great. Yeah. I love dialogue. I love writing dialogue and thinking about how to use it artfully in fiction. It sometimes feels overused, I think, by some writers. So I try to be very judicious when I'm using dialogue and mix up, you know, summary and paraphrase along with literal quotations from the characters. Hopefully just recording the dialogue that actually advances the story and sharpens the reader's sense of the character and good things like that. But thank you. I like the banter that goes on between some of the characters. I tried to make, you know, some of it funny and humorous. Yes. I hope that comes across.
Well, there is a local author who set himself the challenge. He says, I wonder if I could write a novel. He didn't even call it a novel. He said, how far I could get if I wrote only dialogue, no exposition, simply dialogue. And he was able to write a whole book with that. It was a very interesting challenge he set for himself, and he was quite successful at doing that, just the opposite of what you might expect.
Sure. No, I quickly think of While I Lay Dying by Faulkner, right, which is a series of monologues by a number of different characters. So if you put that all together, it's sort of like a chorus of voices. Yeah, you can do anything with fiction as long as you pull it off and charm the reader.
Well, speaking of fiction, though, your first story sounds like it could have really happened.
The shoplifting story. Yeah, it's definitely rooted in realism. You know, both of the stories are, so plausibility is a big question.
And yeah, I had that feeling the way you tell the story. Like, gosh, he's telling this almost like you'd read a memoir.
Yeah, they have that feel. Certainly, the second novella is called Infidels, and it's written in the first person.
That's what contributes to that feeling. Yes.
I think so, yeah. And a reflective adult looking back on his childhood. And yeah, I think you could easily note a lot of similarities between the form of the memoir and especially a story written in that mode. And that's pretty common with contemporary literature. I think, you know, the memoir, the nonfiction writers have borrowed some of the tools of the fiction writers and vice versa, so that those forms maybe are closer than one might think when you use labels like nonfiction or fiction. With shoplifting, that is written in the third person, but it's definitely the idea was to kind of make a snapshot of a young woman, a young mother's life in, you know, the early 2000s, and some attention to what, you know, those challenges are. She's an aspiring writer herself. She's a new mother. She's married. She's mourning the loss of a sister. So she's in the middle of a grieving process. And so there's kind of a busy life with a lot of things going on, and she's struggling to find answers to some of the questions that haunt her throughout that novella.
Well, since we've talked about this first story, why don't you read us, start at the beginning of that story.
Start at the beginning. Okay, sure. The opening of the first novella, which is called Shoplifting, or How Dialectical Materialism Can Change Your Life.
Now, wait a second. I can't let that go by. Shoplifting or How Dialectical Materialism Can Change Your Life.
Yeah.
People say, Rob, what the heck are you mean by dialectical materialism?
Well, just textbook Marxism. But the idea here is that the book is, the novella is at least in part, a somewhat cheeky comment on materialism. There is a lot of shoplifting that goes on literally in the story. Some of it's inadvertent and some of it's quite deliberate. And Metaphorically, though, it's a comment on how sometimes in life we need to borrow things or inhabit other people's mindsets or memories, even to get where we want to go. So, in a sense, Monica, the protagonist, has to, in order to grieve and complete her grieving over the loss of her sister, she has to imaginatively inhabit her sister's memories, appropriate them, and then as a writer, use that material. And so it's a metaphorical kind of theft, if you will.
But we don't know any of this when we start reading this story.
So I'll just read a little bit of the opening.
Good.
Standing in the aisle of her local Kmart, Monica Evans held up a toddler T-shirt for inspection. Every boy's shirt featured an image of a race car or a monster truck, a baseball player or a superhero. It seemed so primal, like, get me a sharp stick and a loincloth already. She wandered across to the girls' section. Here, everything was flowers and birds, yellows and pinks. Equally cliché, she knew, but if you must live your life as a cliché, you could at least choose lavender. Browsing, she found the cutest flower print dress sized for an 18-month-old, and it was on mega reduction. She hesitated, thinking of what her husband would say. Nothing a good, sharp riposte couldn't tame. Into the cart it went. Jacob began squirming in his baby seat. The little guy was probably hungry. Almost bottle time, Monica cooed, hoping to soothe him. At the sound of the magic B word, he let out a yelp and began thrashing as if stung by a bee. In a moment of poor judgment, Monica unstrapped him and set him on the floor. Immediately, Jacob took off. She caught up with him two aisles later in the toys. With what could only be described as animal ferocity, the child ripped items off the shelves faster than his mother could replace them. Finally, she scooped him up and quickly made her way to the checkout line, leaving the toy aisle looking like a tornado had hit it. Jacob wriggled and writhed, a yellow stuffed animal, a giraffe or something, firmly in his mitt. She planned to rip it out of his hands at the last possible moment, yet by the time they'd made it through the checkout line, he wasn't holding it. Unceremoniously dropped, she'd assumed, somewhere along the way. Later that afternoon, Monica dug a hand into her shoulder bag, rooting after one of Jacob's pacifiers, and there, wedged between a spare diaper and her copy of James Fry's A Million Little Pieces, she found Henry the Hammer, a plush stuffed toy, golden yellow, with fawn-like eyes on either side of its head and a distended, goofy grin on its neck. Surprised, she held it before her like some Egyptian artifact.
This is Rob Davidson reading from his newest collection of two novellas, What Some Would Call Lies. And I want to get back to the story, but the title that I just said, What Some Would Call Lies, mm-hmm. That's an intriguing title. I like that title.
Thanks. Yeah, it's it comes from Joan Didion. I used a quote from Slouching Towards Bethlehem as one of the epigraphs. And one of the happy accidents of reading, of course, is that when you're working on something and you're reading somebody else's work and you find the perfect quote and you just realize, that's what I'm writing about. And that's what happened with this Joan Didion quote. The quote goes like this. I tell what some would call lies, for not only have I always had trouble distinguishing between what happened and what merely might have happened, but I remain unconvinced that the distinction, for my purposes, matters. So I love that quote from Joan Didion, and she, I love her writing. She's such a smart, gifted prose writer. But the idea there of whether, you know, when you're writing, if something is true or can be factually corroborated versus the artistic license that a writer might take and bend, if you will, things is so intriguing. And a big part of shoplifting is this idea that the novella
shoplifting.
My novella. A big part of this is this idea of, theft in various forms. So the triggering incident that what I just read there for the book is you know, Monica's son accidentally leaving a store with a toy in his hand. So it's a kind of theft, but certainly not an intentional one. And she thinks about that and the ethics of that and whether she should return it. And it kind of gets her thinking. But then also later when she's beginning to write essays about her sister, because she uses her writing as a catalyst for dealing with her grief, she mistakenly appropriates one of her sister's memories and writes an essay about being lost at the Tippecanoe County Fair, and her mother tells her, that was your sister, not you. And Monica thinks about it and then decides she's just going to keep the essay the way it was written in the first person and continue to write her sister's autobiography in the first person. So the mother, of course, and some other, her therapist, are all questioning her and saying, well, that seems wrong. It's like fiction or something. You're appropriate. And she just ultimately decides not to listen to them, that she needs to do whatever she needs to do and write the best essays that she can write. And for her, like Didion, the distinction doesn't matter between what really happened and what needs to happen in the creative process of writing. So I play around with that in the novella a little bit. There's a more than a little dose of metafiction, I suppose, in the book that way.
My guest is Rob Davidson, and he is a fiction writer, will be one of the presenters at this year's WordSpring. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest is Rob Davidson, who is a talented and award-winning fiction writer. He writes creative fiction. He teaches creative fiction at Chico State University. Well, often writers will write a memoir but not call it fact. They will call it fiction because that mm-hmm. allows them to create dialogue as capturing the essence but not. Of course, you can't recall dialogue from your life.
No, that's the secret, open secret of writing a memoir is that a lot of it is actually, you know, fabricated in that sense. And a writer like James Frey, who I deliberately reference in this book a couple of times, you know, he became quite well known for publishing a novel. Well, he wrote it as a novel, but then ultimately published it as a memoir. And when people did some fact checking and discovered that he'd fabricated incidents, he got publicly shamed by Oprah Winfrey and other mm-hmm. people. And it was a really interesting moment for those of us who pay a lot of attention to fiction and nonfiction in a literary context. You know, he apologized and broke down on crying on TV and stuff like that. It's all on YouTube. You can look it up. But I remember thinking, well, gee, you know, he could have handled that really differently if he just talked about the blurry line between the genres and whether it really matters, actually, if something's labeled mm-hmm. as fiction or nonfiction. A lot of people would say with conviction it does, but there are plenty of writers out there like V.S. Naipaul or Lucia Berlin who deliberately wrote work that blended autobiography and fiction and then don't really get too worked up about the label that's on it. So it's always, to me, it's always an intriguing question about fiction writers who write deeply autobiographical fiction but still call it fiction, or memoirists who call it nonfiction, but we know that if you can't remember what your mother told you 25 years ago but you know you need to write the dialogue, you're going to go ahead and fabricate it. It's just understood. And then readers are going to trust that you're, you know, being as close to true as you can, but in a certain finicky sense, you're not exactly true. So you can always play around with that a little bit.
Plus, if you're writing about your own life, you're also involving others who might not want you to be writing about them. Mm-hmm. So you have to change not only names, but other identifying features mm-hmm. in telling your story for that reason.
That's right. Or quietly, you might have had a moment in your real life with like five people in the room. But when you decide to write your memoir dramatically, you only need three people. so two people don't get mentioned, you know. And I've met many, many writers who, you know, memoirists who've admitted to doing things like that, just kind of quietly making changes. Of course, who's going to know? There's no truth police. But yeah, for what it's worth, when I'm reading a memoir, I just keep in mind those questions. And the writers like Mary Carr, for example, who are very upfront. The Liars Club is one of my favorite, you know, contemporary memoirs. I teach it a lot when I teach the memoir on campus at Chico State. But she openly admits in interviews that she fabricated parts of that book. She can't remember what her dad told her. He told her these long, tall tales. And so she just decided, I'll just make them up. They'll be close, but not the exact thing.
And on the other hand, when I'm reading an autobiography or a memoir, I'm always wondering, now, how much of this was fabricated? But also, if they've labeled it fiction, I wonder, I know this sounds so true, that this must have been drawn from the person's real life, even if they have labeled it fiction.
Sure. And, you know, there are writers like Thomas Wolfe who are, you know, famous for writing very autobiographically rooted fiction. And for what it's worth, I think, as a fiction writer, there's no question that there's always some degree of autobiographical content in fiction, whether it's explicit or implicit. And in a way, it doesn't really matter, but it's always a question that comes up and that people want to sometimes talk about. And I don't mind talking about it, but I also can't, it's not like you can look at a fictional narrative and sort of parcel out how much of this, you know, percentage is, I don't know. It actually, you end up rewriting your memories when you write fiction, because you, when you do borrow something from quote unquote real life and then use it in fiction, I actually find I remember the fictional version that I wrote and don't remember all the details of the so-called original. And my wife and mother frequently point this out to me.
And the more time you tell this story of yourself, the more you believe, you convince yourself this is the way it was.
Well, that's the transformative process of writing. And it's a really powerful act in that way. And that's actually part of what shoplifting is about. Monica feels trapped by, you know, the inability to find closure in grieving for her sister. She's in a marriage that's being tested by her husband is basically out of town 6 days a week. And she's kind of a single mother with a newborn, a toddler. And she's trying to figure out who she is, where she's at. And she's also trying to figure out who her sister was and why her sister died. She can't decide if it was, she doesn't have facts to tell her if it was a suicide or an accidental combination of alcohol and sleeping pills. She wants closure quite naturally, so she decides writing is one way she can kind of process all of these things that are going on. And it does in the novella, the actual process of writing, it's a bit messy because it upsets certain people like her mother. But for her, it is definitely a transformative act.
My guest is Rob Davidson, and his newest collection of fiction, What Some Would Call Lies, consists of two novellas, and we've just been talking about the first one, which has the unusual title of, well, not unusual, but maybe surprising, Shoplifting, or How Dialectical Materialism Can Change Your Life. So that's the first one, and you read us a little bit of that one. And then you said that your second novella also shared some themes with the first.
Yes, Infidels is the second novella, and it also is a book about memory and trauma. It's an adult narrator. His name is Jackie Rose. He's looking back at a spring and early summer when he's 12 years old and his parents are separating, but he's also coming of age. He's met a young girl who's a year older than him, who seems to him quite more initiated into the ways of the world. And he's also found a teacher in school who's challenging him to open his mind up a little bit, look at things like academic disciplines like history, but also just kind of look at life a little differently, realize that, you know, just because you're born in a certain place at a certain time in a certain set of circumstances, you aren't limited necessarily by any of that. You could reinvent yourself, go other places, become someone different. And that teacher kind of wakes him up to some of those possibilities. So it's very much a coming-of-age story, but also a book about, or a story about writing stories. So Shoplifting is using writing as a literal metaphor. And in this Infidels novella, you the act of composing one's own kind of memoiristic history becomes part of what the story is about. Here's a guy who's struggling to make something beautiful out of, as an adult, out of memories that in some cases are quite painful.
Well, I start reading Infidels, and I see in the dead of a Minnesota winter, and I thought, oh, is Rob from Minnesota?
Yeah, I grew up in Duluth, Minnesota. And this work, we were just talking about autobiographical elements. So there's quite a bit of autobiographical detail that I drew on in writing Infidels. I lived there. I played ice hockey. You know, I had teachers kind of like the one that's in here, and friends certainly like the kids that are mentioned in here. So it was kind of fun to go back and collect bits of those memories and then, you know, weave them into a fictional story. And yeah, for whatever reason, I just keep writing about Minnesota and mostly Duluth. It probably because I left that landscape when I was, you know, in my teens, and only periodically went back. So for me, it's really this magical landscape of childhood, and also just a really beautiful place, northern Minnesota. I think the North Shore of Lake Superior is one of the most beautiful areas in the world. So in my mind, it's very rich and resonant.
And as a child, you don't cope with the froze and the ice on your windshield or the sliding on the
You know, to
ice.
Be honest, I didn't even think about it. Now I've lived for California, Northern California for 17 years, so I'm used to a very different kind of climate now, and I like it. But yeah, as a kid growing up, you don't think twice about it. You just if it's
go play in the snow,
you go play hockey, go sledding, go skiing, and yeah, you don't hibernate in winter. You get outside and enjoy it. And as a kid, it was fantastic. We had lots of fun.
Would you like to read us a little sample of Infidels?
Sure. Yeah, just talking about enjoying the winters and the outdoors. I'll read a passage that captures some of that fun about the outdoors and also a little bit about the milieu that this kid, Jackie Rose, enjoyed. Where I grew up in Duluth, as soon as it snowed, we all ran outside and grabbed our sleds, and we would go to a place called Grass Hill. So I wrote about that in the book. Grass Hill was a favorite spot. As soon as the first big winter storm hit, we neighborhood kids clambered up on it with buckets of tap water, icing down a chute on the steepest part. With a bit of crafty shovel work, we engineered a smoothly curved jump at its base. A good run at top speed required you to hit the jump at just the right angle so you'd clear the sidewalk that ran along the base of the hill, landing on a narrow footrail which cut through a stand of birch and poplar. A miscalculation would either spill you onto the frozen concrete sidewalk or send you flying into the trees. These were risks well worth taking, however, for an incomparable rush of terror and glee as you soared through the air. We recorded distances and awarded points for style. There was an unofficial king of the hill, usually one of the older boys, who, with his weight and speed, could achieve Olympian distances. Any fool who had the guts to race down that ice slick and risk splitting his head open was a blood brother, one of the merry idiots who owned that hill. Cowardice and timidity were the only banes. The unlucky soul who found himself perched at the top of the chute, unable to muster the courage to launch, was mercilessly heckled until he made that first run or got the hell out of the way. The absolute worst thing you could do would be to half-commit, bailing midway and thereby damaging the chute, an act of treachery repaid with a fusillade of curses and ice-packed snowballs. Bad things did happen. Jerry Gustafson knocked himself out one time, flying ass over tea kettle, cracking his head on the frozen sidewalk. Even now I wince. His skull sounded just like a dropped bowling ball. There were broken fingers, split lips, twisted ankles. More than one kid caught hell for busting up his sled. They can only take so much punishment. Occasionally a worried parent trudged up the hill to lecture us on the dangers, ordering his unlucky son or daughter home. But these were at best temporary deterrents. Winter is not a time to be holed up in the house staring out a window. When the snow falls, kids don their suits, boots, caps, and mittens. They grab their skates, their skis, their snowshoes, and toboggans, and they race outside. Grass Hill was a proving ground where I learned to conquer fear, performing some minor bit of craziness for the enjoyment of my peers. Few things in childhood pleased me more. There, I had feelings I now understand to be rare, that of having risked mightily, of having given all. In reward, I enjoyed the fraternity of like-minded fools. I might limp home with a frozen hand or a bruised backside, my cheeks wind-burned and nose-chapped. Often I found snow tucked away in corners of my snowsuit that defied the laws of physics, but it was worth it, every crazy minute of it. And as I think of it now, my heart swells.
This has been Rob Davidson. He's reading from his latest collection, it consists of two novellas, and the title of this collection is What Some Would Call Lies. He's just been reading from the second novella, Infidels. Thank you so much for coming by, Rob.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here.
That was award-winning author Rob Davidson, who teaches creative writing and American literature at California State University. And my next guest is Debbie Dodds from Portland, Oregon, who will be in town to give two workshops, horror writing and humor writing. She received a BFA from New York University in drama and acting and an MFA in creative writing from Antioch University. As an actress, she was featured in independent films and television shows. She wrote and performed in stage shows at both Disneyland and Disney World. She did weekly improv comedy and has now written a young adult novel, Amish Guys Don't Call. Debbie Dodds, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, you have such a varied background, and did you start your career? Because you majored in drama acting, mm-hmm. and you were in independent films and television shows. Are there any that we would recognize?
I did a special with Jerry Seinfeld called Abbott and Costello Meet Jerry Seinfeld that aired during his regular time slot when he was doing Seinfeld. It was a Thanksgiving special, and so people know that from the name recognition. And then I did a lot of independent horror films, which I hope you haven't seen.
Now, wait a second.
Sex,
horror films?
And Zombie Republicans and Bloodbath and, you know, some real classics.
So where would we not be able to see these? YouTube?
I don't know. I plead the fifth.
Well, that does come up because I think you're going to be doing at WordSpring a workshop on horror writing? Horror?
Right, yes. Yes, and although my young adult novel is not of that genre, I've been published in over 20 anthologies now, and I would say five or six of them are horror or sci-fi based stories. I enjoy reading them. I enjoy watching horror movies, so it makes sense that I would have been in horror movies and that I'm writing horror.
Yeah, because you also, in addition to acting, you write, and you wrote and performed stage shows at Disneyland and Disney World. What was the nature of those shows, Debbie?
Right out of college, I got my degree from NYU, and I was going to go do theater. And I went to an audition for Disney World, and I got cast in, I think it's the longest-running show now at the studios, which used to be MGM Studios, but it was called Streetmosphere at the time. And it is a 1940s kind of interactive improvisation show, and I played the girl off the bus, and I created my character, and I co-wrote sketches with people, and it was wonderful, but I didn't see myself working at Disney for the rest of my life. So I said, well, never again. I'm leaving Disney. And I went out to California, and I was in California for about 3 or 4 years, and I really needed dental insurance, and I really needed some stability. And so I auditioned for Disneyland, and I got cast in a show there. And I did many, many shows at Disneyland. I worked there on and off for about 10 years.
Oh, that's
11 years.
Yeah, that's quite a career.
Yep.
I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. We will be featuring a couple of writers today who will be presenters at Butte College's annual WordSpring Creative Writing Conference. Thank you. I'm back with my guest, Debbie Dodds, from Portland, Oregon, who will be in town to give two workshops, horror writing and humor writing. Well, then how did you get into improv comedy?
Well, improv was the first thing I ever did. When I was in middle school, I was very shy and very bullied, and just I was a dorky little kid. And I liked to read all the time, and my mom said, oh, we've got to, you know, kind of get you out and get you into something that you loved. And I did love doing plays, and so she enrolled me in an improv class, and I started doing improv comedy, and I loved it. And I got my equity card when I was 16 and started doing theater. In fact, my first play was All Wilderness, professional play. I did at the Fulton Opera House. And then that was it. That was my true love. So I, you know, married my acting career and was faithful to it for many, many years. And after a while, I started creating projects. I co-wrote a film script, and I was creating projects, and I realized I was enjoying the writing part more than the acting. So I refocused, and I went back to school and got my MFA.
You know, it's interesting that it seems like most people who want to break into acting get their degree and then go out and try to break into acting. But on the other hand, you had your improv comedy experience before you went to college.
Yes, I did. And in fact, there's a funny story. One summer, I needed to take a break from acting. I'd been professionally acting. I was doing plays at NYU, back to back. I did a play with a Jewish American theater. I did summer plays. I did Renaissance fairs. And I was just exhausted. And so I said, well, I'm just going to be a normal person. I'm going to waitress. So I got a job in Rehoboth Beach, Delaware, as a waitress. And after 3 days, I was fired. It was a horrible waitress. And it was a disaster. And I had already rented my place for the summer in Rehoboth Beach. And I was walking along the beach at twilight. And I looked up in the window of a restaurant. I swear to God, there was a sign that said, actor wanted.
Oh my.
And I said, you've got to be kidding me. And I walked up, I walked in. They said, yeah, we want to do a summer play. We don't know anything about it. And I said, well, not only can I act in it, I can write and direct it too. And that was it. And I said, I've got to be the only person who's ever fired from a waitressing job and I had to act to support myself.
Yeah, the very opposite of what usually happens.
Exactly.
Because I was thinking when you said you applied to be a waitress, I thought, now that's a cliche. The waitress who's just waiting tables till she breaks into acting.
Yeah. Nope. Went the other way for me.
My guest is Debbie Dodds, and she is a writer, actress, performer, and she will be here in Chico for the Butte County Creative Writing Conference, Word Spring. That's taking place on April 27th. And Debbie, you are going to be presenting workshops. We mentioned that you're going to be presenting a workshop on horror writing. And I think you're doing a couple of workshops.
I am. I'm doing another one on humor writing. So kind of my two favorite loves in both acting and writing are, and they have much more in common than a lot of people think because they work well together. A lot of horror has an element of humor in it to kind of lighten it and make it more palatable. And as we know, most comedy is actually rooted in tragic events. So you've got kind of this duality between the two. So I'm really excited to be able to do two workshops.
Well, now, is that something you can teach people, how to be funny in their writing?
That's a great question. That is an often debated question, and it's often debated in writing and acting. Can you teach someone to be funny? I will equivocate a little bit. There are some tricks, and I can help you with the tricks. I can help with very basic things like the rule of three, K sounds are funny, you know, different tricks like that. I can also share different styles of humor because that's another thing. What one person finds funny, another person might not find funny. For example, dark humor. Some people, you know, do not find dark humor, gallows humor, funny at all, and other people find it funny. Other people find slapstick funny. I'm not a big fan of slapstick, but I recognize it. You know, setting someone up in a physical situation where they're, you know, having to, the one from I Love Lucy always comes to mind, where she's having to deal with the candy on the conveyor belt.
Oh, that's
and,
classic.
She doesn't know where to put it. Exactly. So those types of things, you know, everybody has their proclivities and everybody has their favorite type of humor. So yeah, I would say you can learn to write humor. And you can find what you naturally find funny and bring that out.
You just mentioned the old TV comedy series I Love Lucy, and that must have been one of your inspirations, if I may use that term. Maybe Jerry Seinfeld. Who were your inspirations when it came to humor?
Oh, I'm one of those people who I find a lot of things very funny. I think very early on, you know, when I was a little kid, it was Carol Burnett. And then, you know, you'd watch the reruns and stuff in the afternoons. And absolutely, that I loved the Seinfeld show before I was on the Seinfeld, you know, before I worked with Seinfeld. So that was wonderful. I've always loved Saturday Night Live, Mad TV when that used to be around, all of those kind of sketch comedy shows that have a political edge to them, broad characters, observations of human behavior.
Well, when you give a workshop on humor writing, do you draw on, do you use these you just cited as examples for your students in the workshop?
I do. I have tons of examples, and I have lots of handouts, and we do, I'm a very active teacher. I like to do exercises in class, and I actually have students come up and do some improv things, and we use that, like improv games that actors use to generate ideas for writing.
My guest is Debbie Dodds, and she has a new young adult novel, Amish Guys Don't Call. We've been talking about her background in acting and improv. But now you also, is this your only novel that you've written, Amish Guys Don't Call?
This is my first, yes. I'm currently working on three other ones because I get easily bored, and so I have to bounce back and forth between them and see which one's catching my fancy at the time. But yes, this is the first published novel.
And you chose as your first novel a young adult novel. And how did you happen to choose that audience as opposed to, or that group of readers, as opposed to adults?
You know, that's funny because I didn't. I just wrote the story that was in my head. In fact, I was kind of surprised when I started pitching it to agents and publishers, and they said, oh, so it's young adult. And I said, no, not necessarily. It has a 17-year-old protagonist, but it's not necessarily young adult. And it's one of my favorite pieces of feedback that I get from adults and from teenagers who say, oh, you didn't, you know, write this in a style that's necessarily aimed for, you know, young people. It just happens to feature young people as the main characters. But I would say I love it when, you know, a 14-year-old reads a novel and enjoys it, but I also love it when I've got a bunch of reviews on my Amazon and my Goodreads page from, like, 50-year-old, 45-year-old men who are like, well, I didn't think I would be very interested in a novel about a 17-year-old girl, but I really enjoyed this, and I treasure this. I love those.
Well, one writer I interviewed chose that category of young adult writing because he said it's so hard to break into any ranking for adult novels. But he said the young adult novel, you can more likely to have a bestseller in that category because you're less competition, whereas the competition for novels is tremendous. So
I don't know if that's true, but that if he did the market research on that, hats off to him. I am far from that calculating. I never think about, you know, I think about my audience. I want my audience to enjoy my story, but I don't ever really think about what's going to sell the most or what's going to hit or would it be easier to break in. Never really considered much of that when I was writing.
So you've been through this, all these experiences on stage and writing, and then you sit down and write a young adult novel, Amish Guys Don't Call. And where did the inspiration come from for this novel, Debbie?
I moved around when I was growing up quite a bit. I lived in 13 different places before I was in the fifth grade. So we landed after many different states and many different places, we landed in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And we moved there at a time when I think I was extremely impressionable and I really wanted to embrace and find out about this new place that I had moved. And the Amish are such a feature in Lancaster. You know, they're riding around their horse and buggies. You catch sights of them, you know, out in their farms and everything. And it was kind of exciting for me that there was this group of people that were living in such a different way. And so I read everything and I studied them. And at one point, my brother even worked for an Amish family, which is very unusual. But his soccer coach was Scottish. And a lot of the Amish people actually trust Europeans a little bit more than they trust sometimes, you know, the people in their community, the Americans in their community, who, weirdly, they call English. It's a little confusing. But so I just had this fascination, and I, you know, learned and studied and watched and did all of that. And I had an experience when I was about 16, 17, about the age of the protagonist in my book. I was at Rick's Place, which is an under 21 club. It still exists in Lancaster, and it's for under 21 kids from all different schools to go and socialize and dance. And it's open on Saturday nights, and there's no alcohol. And there is a really cute boy who I would dance with sometimes. And he looked like Rick Springfield, you know, and I was just crazy about him. And I finally got up the nerve, and I handed him my phone number, and he didn't call me. And that was, you know, daunting and sad. But he kept asking me to dance week after week. He would ask me to dance. I thought maybe he lost it, so I gave it to him again. Again, he didn't call me. Finally, somebody said, well, that's his cousin over there. And so I walked over and talked to his cousin named Chet, and I said, what is going on? Why is Sam not giving me a call? And he laughed and he said, well, they don't have a phone in their house for one. And I said, what? He said, yeah, they're old order Mennonite. And I said, oh, you know, and I was completely flummoxed by this. And that was it. You know, nothing ever happened. I didn't pursue it. I think I avoided him when dances came up because I didn't know how to handle it, because it is such a different community and they really don't, you know, date and marry outside the Amish Mennonite community. Mennonite's a little bit more open, but Old Order Mennonite's very close to being Amish. So, yeah, and the idea for this book started with a what if. Like, what if it had gone a different way? What if that hadn't been so daunting to me and we had continued to go out, and what would that relationship be like? So that's kind of...
I think your
story
novel
behind it
would be of interest to adults and young adults, too, because they are somewhat of a mystery, the Amish community.
Mm-hmm.
There was a movie that Harrison Ford was in that involved someone from this
Witness.
Community. Yeah, Witness. And
yeah.
That's about all we ever hear in the popular media exposure we have to the Amish community. So it's understandable that you wouldn't know they didn't have telephones.
Right. Well, and I mean, I just didn't know he was Mennonite. And it turns out, actually, I found out later, his family had been Amish the generation before. A little side note, he and his aunt went on to form Aunt Anne's Pretzels. So he actually left kind of the more strict Mennonite faith, and he became quite a millionaire many times over with Aunt Anne's Pretzels. And he opened a place in Lancaster, which is a giant sports complex called Spooky Nook. And I found all of this out because after I wrote the book, I thought, I wonder what ever happened to him. And I Googled him and found out, like, oh, my goodness, he did pretty well for himself. So yeah, I haven't seen him. I haven't. People have told me that he's aware of the book out there. So one of these days, maybe he'll contact me and we can have a laugh about it, how he inspired the book.
My guest is writer, actress Debbie Dodds, and she has a young adult novel, Amish Guys Don't Call. You know, Debbie, you mentioned moving around a good bit when you were young, and that would make it understandable. You would be a target of bullies because here's the new kid. Let's give her a hard time. And
yeah,
particularly since you were shy.
That was part of it, and I was, as I said, it was kind of bookish and academic, and I probably picked up things from the different states that I lived in that went, you know, I would go to another state, it would seem odd or weird. I remember there was an incident with Jordache jeans. I had Jordache jeans and everybody else had Levi's, and that was a big deal. And so that informs the book, too. There's actually a big subplot, and Amish guys don't call, I've updated it, it's cyberbullying, but there's a big theme of being an outcast in your community, because Zach actually has left the Amish community. You can't, if you decide not to get baptized to the church, they shun you. And so his family and some of the stricter communities, and so his family has decided to shun him. So he has no more family. He has no more community. And then when Sam starts going out with him and her friends discover he's Amish, they start cyberbullying her and shunning her, basically the modern day equivalent of the shunning. So they're both kind of facing an isolation and trying to navigate as young people, feeling like they've lost their sense of community, which is so important when you're a teenager. It's everything. Your friends are so, and your family are such a tether. And that was a big theme for me, is what happens when you feel like you're alone in the world.
My guest is Debbie Dodds, and she is an actress, writer, performer, improv comedy, and her novel, young adult novel, is Amish Guys Don't Call. She will be in Chico April 27th for a couple of workshops. Tell us again, Debbie, before we say goodbye, what your workshops will be.
I'm teaching a workshop on humor, and then I'm teaching another one on horror writing.
Well, we will look forward to welcoming you for Word Spring. This is held at Butte College, and registration is open now. It's been a pleasure talking to you, Debbie.
Thank you so much. It's been great talking to you.
Again, Debbie Dodds will be in Chico April 27th for a couple of workshops with Butte College's Word Spring.
Been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.